Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 28th, 2009, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. There are few issues in my mind as important in media and communication, and perhaps even in our entire society, than the commercialization of our culture, particularly, but not exclusively, childhood. Today, we're privileged to have as our guest one of the real experts on this subject, author of numerous books, activist on this, researcher. Susan Lynn will be joining us today on Media Matters for the full hour. So please stay tuned for the program. But before we get to Dr. Lynn, let's go now to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This spring, Time Warner Cable announced that it would begin charging their internet customers based on bandwidth consumption, putting caps on what used to be an unlimited service. One of the three cities targeted to test out the new pricing scheme was Rochester, New York. A group of doctors complained to Congressman Eric Massa that their broadband bills would triple overnight, from about $50 per month to a whopping $150 per month. And a local consumer reporter named Philip Dampier began organizing opposition to the price hikes online at a site he called Stop the Cap. Thousands of calls and letters, encouraged by Stop the Cap and Free Press, began coming into Capitol Hill, pointing out that the extreme price hikes seemed completely disconnected from any increased costs facing the company. And under pressure from Massa and New York Senator Chuck Schumer, Time Warner Cable dropped their plan for now. Time Warner characterized the move as a temporary setback, saying that the public only needed to be educated about the consumer benefits of their scheme. Massa wants to make sure that any efforts to institute unfair broadband pricing schemes are stopped before they begin. He spoke with the press last week about his new bill, H.R. 2902, the Broadband Internet Fairness Act.
This bill aims to do one basic thing, increase competition, by addressing and requiring internet service providers to submit plans to the Federal Trade Commission in very close consultation with the FCC if they plan to move to a usage-based plan. It prohibits volume usage plans if the FTC determines that these plans are imposing rates, terms, and conditions, and this is very important, that are unjustly unreasonable, unreasonably discriminatory.
Philip Dampier of StopTheCap.com told reporters that most internet service providers are moving towards these pricing schemes, and some are already in the testing phase.
AT&T is testing their own cap program in two cities. And additionally, we have concerns from people who have satellite and other kinds of technologies to receive this data that are all facing limits. It's sort of a limbo dance to the bottom. Who can set the lowest cap for the highest price?
Massa said that the success of the bill will be driven by the millions of consumers who contact their representatives.
This is all about getting citizens involved in legislation. So someone asked me the other day, well, why do you have all these people involved in this? And the answer is because we're doing the people's business.
For more information about the Broadband Internet Fairness Act, go to freepress.net or stopthecap.com.
The Allied Media Conference began 11 years ago as an event focused mostly on independent print and zine publishers. But over the past decade, the conference has transformed along with the media and now incorporates a wide range of issues and includes artists, educators, and social justice organizers who use media as a tool for change. This year's conference will take place on July 16th to the 19th in Detroit, with 1,000 participants from across the country. Allied Media's Jenny Lee talks about the conference's connection to the city, which has been grappling with the collapse of the auto industry.
Well, there's a conversation that's grown over the past few years about the role of independent media making in advancing new forms of economic development in Detroit. And right now, with the broadband work that's happening, and Michigan has this emerging film industry, and a lot of the independent media work that's been on the ground for so many years, it's all kind of converging to really advance a new vision for the role of media, arts, and culture in transforming cities like Detroit that have been tied to more industrial forms of economic development.
This year's conference will also go international. Using Skype, conference participants will have interactive live sessions with communities across the globe. That includes a live press conference with people in Atenco, Mexico, who have been using video to tell the world about their indigenous communities' struggle with the Mexican government over land. There will also be a conversation between U.S. and Palestinian youth media organizations.
Going from Detroit, from our very local and unique context here to the national relationships that have been built through the AMC over the years beyond the U.S. and connecting with people in other places who face such similar struggles as a lot of communities in the U.S. here, and are using media in really similar ways to advance, you know, the transformation of the world that we need to see.
The Allied Media Conference is also about creating media. One workshop will connect hip-hop artists in Johannesburg, South Africa, who will be using file-sharing software to share beats and write songs, performing live via Skype.
There's an open media lab in the basement of the conference center where people can go throughout the weekend to really just get their hands dirty with making media. And this year, it's even going to involve building the technology that we use for our media production.
That includes building a 1-watt radio transmitter, as well as taking apart and rebuilding computers with open source software for a new community media center set to open in Detroit in the fall. For more information about the Allied Media Conference, visit alliedmediaconference.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 28th, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a show on a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and I suspect many of our listeners, but one that I regret to say, compared to almost any other issue we take up on Media Matters, gets almost no attention in the media themselves for reasons I think will almost become self-evident. Our guest today is Susan Lin, the author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Children, and the brand new book just out in paperback, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. She's a psychologist at the Judge Baker Children's Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston, as well as a director and co-founder for the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. She's been on our show before, and it's a privilege to welcome her back. Susan Lin, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, hi, Bob. It's so great to be talking to you again.
Well, I enjoyed the new book, published by New Press, I might add,
as
I read it in preparation for the program, and it has a lot of new material in it. And let's just start right in. I was surprised. I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised to see that the United Nations characterizes play as a basic right in its Convention on the Rights of Children.
Yes, yes, that's really wonderful, isn't it? And they're really accurate about that. I mean, it should be a basic right, and it's essential to children's health and well-being. Yet, as a society, we seem to be doing everything we can to really deprive children of opportunities to play. It's concerning.
Yeah, well, that's what you wrote a book about.
Yeah, concerning's mild.
Well, yeah, and I'd say once one reads this book, when you think about it, the importance of play becomes, I wouldn't say self-evident, but becomes quite clear, and people only need to think about their own lives and the role play has been in their own development. But, you know, you're a psychologist and a therapist, and you've worked with children in particular on issues of play. Why is play important? And for people who have never really thought about this, what does play do for human development, human happiness that is so irreplaceable?
It's the foundation of learning. It's how we learn how to learn. It's the foundation of creativity. It's the way children learn constructive problem solving. It's the way that they learn to self-regulate, and with children, that's a good thing, unlike with corporations. It's the way that children wrestle with life to make meaning of it. And play is the foundation of art, of science, of critical thinking, of religion. It is absolutely essential to our mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being.
You know, I remember growing up, and I'm dating myself here, but I've talked to friends about this, and I think they all had almost the exact same experience I did in my generation, coming of age basically in the 1960s to, I guess, a tad of the 50s. And this goes to friends into the 70s. And I basically recall having pretty much unregulated time after school on weekends. You know, some stuff my parents would have me do, but more or less I was on my own to figure out how to entertain myself. And that's sort of gone now, isn't it?
Yes. That's very concerning. And, you know, organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, and there's research documenting that kids are doing that kind of, engaged in that kind of self-initiated play, you know, so much less than they used to be. I mean, it's really an endangered species.
You say in the book, Susan Lynn, and this is quite a comment, that in play, in the United States, to play, for children to play, is countercultural.
Right.
Because it's a threat to corporate profits, which seems to be really the thesis of your book. Explain that.
Well, children who play creatively need less of the things that corporations sell to us. Children who play creatively can pick up a stick and transform it into Harry Potter's wand. They don't need the actual wand. They can, if they need to play, if they want to become a superhero, they don't need the costume. They don't need the, you know, Incredible Hulk's, you know, gloves that, you know, talk every time you punch somebody or things like that. They can, you know, take a box and make it into something else. And that is absolutely, it's not lucrative. Creative play is not lucrative. And you know, it's the, you know, the toy companies, the media companies are really doing everything they can to insert their brands into children's lives. And one of the primary ways that they do this is through brand licensing. So, you know, we have these, for instance, we have these four very violent films that have come out in the past couple of months, the Transformers film, the X-Men film, the Star Trek movie, and the Terminator movie, and now we have a G.I. Joe movie coming out. Well, we at Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, we've been tracking the toy advertisements, you know, for these films, and the way that these films are advertised to young children. They're rated PG-13, but they're advertised to young children. We found over 2,700 commercials between March 14th and June 14th on children's channels touting these shows, and also many of the commercials were touting, were selling the toys that go along with these films, and kids play less creatively with media-linked toys.
Susan Lynn, now, some people say, look, no one's forcing kids to play with these toys. They could go outside and pick up a rock and pretend it was something else or a stick. They'd rather, apparently, by their own behavior, play with these corporate-produced toys.
Well, I think, yes, there are some people who would say that.
You're not one of them, I suspect.
I talk to some of them. Yes, I do. but, you know, the thing is that children are immersed in commercial culture, and they're immersed in these products. That prevent them from playing. Children are born with an innate capacity to play, but it's something that they have to develop, and that ordinarily they would develop in just, you know, a normal childhood. The problem is that today, you know, starting from infancy, kids are immersed in screens, and they're immersed in these electronic toys, where the toys have so much more fun than the kids, And so they don't even learn how to play, and so then as they get older, they do need these toys because they don't know what to do if they don't have them, and that's the part that's terribly, terribly concerning. They become dependent on them, and parents are dependent on them, and parents are taught through marketing to believe that they have to have these things in order for the children to be happy and in order for the children to play. It's a complete scam, really, and American childhood is now all wrapped up in this.
How long has this been going on, or when did it, you know, sort of crystallize, or in the way it is today? How is this, one generation, a decade? How would you characterize it?
I think that the key incident was when the FCC was forced to deregulate children's television, and then it became fine to create programming in order to sell toys. The program length commercial was made legal, and that's when things really shifted. And there was marketing to kids before that, and children growing up in the 50s did have some licensed toys, but it's nothing like it was today. So I think that that's one thing. And I also think that the unprecedented convergence of unfettered, unregulated commercialism and this ubiquitous, miniaturized, sophisticated technology is a disaster for children in so many ways, but it is a disaster for their creative play. And I thought about this a lot when I was writing the book, because I'm not anti-media. I worked in television. I worked with Fred Rogers. I came of age at a time when there was hope that television could really be a positive force in children's lives. And in fact, television had a profound influence on me when I was, positive influence on me when I was a child. Before I became a psychologist, I was a ventriloquist, and I still am, but I earned my living that way for a lot of my life, and I became a ventriloquist because of television. And I don't come from a family of ventriloquists. You know, my father sold aluminum siding. My mother was in child development. They moved their lips when they talked. So I became a ventriloquist because I saw Paul Winchell on television, and it just fascinated me. And also, I'm dating myself, but Walt Disney's Peter Pan, which I saw in a movie theater when I was six, and Flash Gordon, which is a series that I saw on television as a young child, just also had a profound effect on my fantasy life. And I played Flash Gordon and Peter Pan for years and with great joy, and I have so many wonderful memories of that. And as I was writing the case for make-believe, I was really struggling with how can I be so critical of the commercial culture today when I had those experiences. And then I realized that there's a difference, several differences, and one of them is access. That I saw Peter Pan once in a theater when I was six. I didn't see it again until I was 19, and it was reissued. And if I wanted to evoke the joy that film brought to me, if I wanted to invoke those feelings and the magic of it, then I had to play. I had no other choice. But today, kids see these films and these television programs over and over and over again. They see them. They might go to the movies and see them. They see them on DVDs. They see them in the back seat of their parents' cars. They can see them on cell phones. They can see them on iPods. And the thing about screen media is that it is such a great memory aid, and that's why it's not so great for creativity. And so they remember the films, and then when they play the films, they're imitating. They're not really playing creatively.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Susan Lin, the author of the new book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, just out in paper now with New Press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Susan Lin, the telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Susan Lin, I know that you talk in the book to some great extent about toys and the relationship of children to toys and toys and play. And one of the big developments in the last 10 years, I think, probably goes back further, but certainly it's blasted off in the last 10 or 15 years, has been interactive toys, where toys are sort of not inanimate objects anymore, but actually, you know, have to speak and do all sorts of other stuff. Some people would argue that, well, this is great. This is introducing sort of an active agency here to a toy rather than just being passive consumption. Is that your response?
Well, first of all, I'm wondering who these some people are that you're talking to, Bob.
I don't know who they are, but they're not anyone who's read your book. I'll put it that way, but they're. But I mean, these are the comments I have actually when I talk to people who just haven't really thought about the issue, and their assumption is, and I think maybe that a better way to put it is, this is the way these toys are characterized by the people who produce them.
That's true, and there is a sense that these toys are These toys are good for children, and the fact that the thing is that the toys don't need agency. The kids need agency, and the more agency a toy has, the less agency a child has. A good toy, a toy that really engenders creativity, is 90% child and maybe 10% toy. So in order to play, the children have to exercise their creativity. They have to bring themselves to their play, and that's what makes play so valuable to children. I mean, if a toy chirps and beeps and talks and dances on its own, the children aren't doing anything. And the thing about these toys is that they advertise so well. Because in a way, I think, you know, our fantasy about our toys when we're little is that they're going to come to life, and they'll be companions to us. And so when you see a 15-second or a 30-second commercial for a toy that talks, that's the pull. And then there's, you know, the sense, you know, because as a country we're so in love with technology, you know, we think, wow, you know, isn't this great, and technology is good, and our kids should have technology and all that. And so parents buy these toys, and then what happens is that they end up in a closet. I mean, how many times can you push a button for Tickle Me Elmo and watch Elmo laugh? I mean, how long is that, you know, can that be entertaining? For how long? I don't think very long.
Yeah, I, based on my experience with my daughters, I would say you've nailed that one.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, Susan, we've got three callers already who've called in and want to speak with you, so let's get to the phone lines now. Again, our guest here on Media Matters today, Susan Lynn, author of the new book, The Case for Make-Believe. We're talking about play in a commercialized world in which there's vast billions to be made by selling stuff to kids. Is there any room for kids to play? Let's go now to our first caller, line four. On a cell phone, you're on the air with Susan Lynn.
Yeah, hi, thank you. One factor, I think I agree with everything Miss Linda's saying. And in fact, I agree with everything you say. I think there's something being left out of this formula here, and I think it's difficult for progressives to kind of deal with. And it's something that occurred at the same time that the ultra-consumerism and movies and TV really got rolling about the same time. Was women going back to work, mothers specifically going back to work. In the 50s and 60s, when we grew up, and I grew up in the same neighborhood Miss Lynn did, there were herds of children running all over the place, doing all kinds of things, making tree houses, digging, having rock fights, the whole bit. But there were lots of mothers around watching them and sort of making things happen so the trouble didn't happen and everybody kind of behaved. But with Reaganism and the destruction of the wages for the average person, women were forced to go to work. Now, it's great women work, and they should have the same right to work as men do, but often it wasn't a matter of real choice. It was a matter of economic necessity. And the fact that there are, in the modern world, there's so few adults around during the day to take care of kids really leads to a lot of this plotting in front of the TV. I have friends with small kids, and they have those kids scheduled every minute. The minute they get out of school, they got a thing, and then they got another thing to go to. But if they didn't schedule them, they live in an apartment building, these kids would sit around, watch TV, and get fat. So the ultra-scheduling is sort of a necessity because the entire working adult family has to work. They're totally stressed out trying to make ends meet, and there really is no time to go back to what we grew up in. I think that's a factor that you should deeply take into consideration with this whole thing.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Susan Lynn, why don't you deeply take that into consideration right now? What do you think?
Right, and I do take that into consideration in my book also. I think that the caller has a good point, that when we have, that the point is that when both parents are in the workplace, there aren't adults, and it doesn't have to be women, it could be men, at home paying attention so that the phenomenon of kids coming home after school and just playing or being able to be out, you know, in the neighborhood, I mean, that's really ended in most places, and that is a concerning, and it is a factor in the demise of play. But, you know, part of that is we don't support working families in this country. And even, you know, if people do need to work, if both parents want to work, we also need after-school programs that are play-based. I mean, that is another option for today's society that we don't have. Mm-hmm. But, there's an enormous pressure on the whole No Child Left Behind and teachers teaching to test and after-school programs have become much more structured, and that is a problem. And that's another way that nurturing creative play has become counterculture is that when parents are lucky enough or to have one parent at home, then there aren't any other parents around. And the other kids are all in after-school programs, and so that gets hard.
That's true. Our guest today, again, Susan Lynn. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. The phone number to talk with Susan Lynn is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Susan Lynn, the author of the new book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, cell phone, you're on the air with Susan Lynn.
Hello?
Hello, yes, that's you. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Hi. I'd say I grew up playing creatively, and I believe in giving children the room to breathe. But my question is as far as playing. But in today's society where technology is developing, I think you might have touched on it a little bit, but especially things outside of toys now that younger kids are getting a hold of the internet and cell phones, how do you balance time playing creatively, as you say, with the technology that children do need to learn? I mean, I find myself behind the curve in certain instances, and I'm still learning a lot of things about computers and getting a grasp on that those things, I suppose. You know, how much do you immerse your children in those in the developing technology? How much do you push that, and how could, you know, once they find themselves good or getting better at, you know, text messaging or chatting on the internet, you know, well, that'll take away time for creative playing, and then maybe they'll just put it behind them completely. But it's necessary to learn those things in today's world, or you won't make it professionally, I suppose. Thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, caller. And let me just add a human dimension to that. My wife and I had that issue with our first daughter where, you know, we tried to hold her off from technology for a long time, having a computer. And this is going back, you know, into the early to mid-90s, so it was before the web really took off and exploded. And, you know, we did feel that sort of guilt the caller talked about. Boy, you know, we go to some of our colleagues or friends' houses, and their kids would be like whiz bangs at age 5 on the computer, and we felt like, you know, our daughter's going to be digging ditches when she grew up. So how do you address a question like that?
Well, let me ask you, how's your daughter doing?
Oh, that's another story. No, she's doing great, but yeah.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time for children under the age of 2. There's no evidence that babies watching screens or engaged with screens are learning anything useful to them when they're engaged with screens. And I think that that parents are going to be grappling with, and children are going to be scrappling with, screen media and the things it sells for all of childhood. You know, it's going to be the cause of tension in the house. It is so consuming and so powerful and habituating that I think for younger children, that the more that you can give them opportunities to take their pleasure from interacting with the world rather than a screen, and the more that they have that base, and the more that they can develop their own inner resources for exploring and for thinking about the world, the better off they're going to be in dealing with this, you know, media saturated consumer society that we've created.
But what about the concern parents are going to have, like the caller just had, that, getting past age two, getting up into school age years now, that, you know, in this society, since everything is online increasingly, that if you weren't completely savvy and immersed in digital technologies, it's not just that you'd be socially ostracized, but you might be economically and civically ostracized.
Right. And so I agree that we do have to introduce, you know, technology into children's lives. I'm thinking that it doesn't have to be a preschool, and I don't think that actually, as a society, we know when a really good time to introduce it is. But you know, I think that, and I have colleagues who would really take a harder line on this than I do. But I would think like by seven, you know, or eight, that it's there are things that children can do on a computer that might be useful to them. But I just really think that and also the kids are going to be exposed to the technology anyway. They're going to see you online, they're going to see you on a cell phone. I mean they're going to be exposed to the technology at school unless you've moved to the woods or maybe you live in Berkeley. When they go over to somebody's house, they're going to be exposed to technology. So I don't have a hard and fast answer for you, but I think that, you know, most of the educational products that are marketed to preschool kids are pretty much phony in terms of their educational value.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest on Media Matters today, Susan Lin, author of the book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, just out now in paperback. The phone number here, by the way, at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go now to line one, Decatur. You're on the air with Susan Lin.
Yeah, good afternoon. It seems to me that children today are imagination deprived. Everything that they see and touch, they don't have to use their imagination. I'm going to date myself. I grew up in the 50s when we were late in getting TV sets, so I listened to old-time radio. And you're sitting there imagining the scene that's going on. You're listening to the audio only, and you're imagining the visualizing it in your brain. Also, by reading books, you visualize things. And it seems like to me that that's one of the key things. If you can't encourage imagination and you can't see it in your mind's eye, you're never going to be creative. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Susan Lin, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a really good point. And, I mean, it's kind of hard to talk about in a way because it sounds, you know, when we start talking about, you know, oh, we used to play outside and everything, it's easy to think that we're sort of waxing nostalgic and, you know, the good old days and, you know, things like that. But I think we're at a point where we need to think about whether, you know, the people who are nurturing creative play and their children who are, you know, taking a stand on the commercialism, who are encouraging their kids to play what are called old-fashioned games, whether that's retro or revolutionary now. I think it's revolutionary.
Susan Lin, one thing that, as I was reading your book, it occurred to me, I know that there are some authors now, including a professor, I believe, at the University of Wisconsin, who are making very much a contrarian argument to yours, that, and not necessarily about commercialism per se, but some probably do, but more about technology, and that kids immersing themselves in digital technology is actually just really good, and people who don't appreciate that are just so tied to the past, they don't see the great benefits. Are you familiar, have you looked at some of that work that people are making about how great it is for kids to be immersed into digital technology?
Yes, and first of all, we have to talk about what age kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly there are really, really creative things that teenagers can do online, and maybe that pre-teenagers can do with digital technology. But if you look at the best-selling, you know, websites or toys for kids, for younger children, they're antithetical. They're antithetical to creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to, there's a lot of research going on now about, or some research going on about media and very young children. And I was talking to one of the researchers, and what she was saying is that that babies, for instance, until the age of about 30 months, babies really don't understand television. They don't they don't get anything out of it. But the way what they're starting to show is if parents sit down with them and point things out on the television that the kids can start to learn from it. But I, when she said that to me, I mean, I thought that was kind of horrifying because what the parents are doing is training kids to turn to screens. And I think that what we have to do is raise children that can use technology but aren't hooked on it and can take satisfaction, find their satisfaction from life outside of a screen. And so I don't think we need to ban technology from the lives of older kids. I do think that for younger children, that you know, the longer that you can hold out, the richer inner life they're going to be able to have, and that's so important.
You know, one of the toys you mentioned in the book, and I think you might have been alluding to it just now, is a toy I came in contact with almost a decade ago. When some friends of ours, we were visiting, and they had a newborn, and it's a toy called Baby Einstein, and our friends were deeply concerned that their child be given the best possible love and attention. They were doting parents to a fault, and this toy was allegedly going to make their child especially brilliant. You really zero in on this sort of, specifically Baby Einstein, but all this genre of sort of new media toys is, frankly, is a hoax.
Yes, it is. It is a scam. There is, as I said earlier, there's no evidence that media for babies is educational, and there's some small evidence that it may be harmful. And these products are marketed to parents as being educational when the companies have no evidence of that. And the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood a few years ago filed a Federal Trade Commission complaint against three baby video companies. And the FTC, and it was the Bush Federal Trade Commission, so they didn't want to regulate anything, they put pressure on two of the companies to really change their marketing. And on the other hand, the companies never had to acknowledge that they were doing it. I mean, there mm-hmm. was nothing sent out to parents. It was not an entirely, by any means, an entirely satisfactory conclusion. But, you know, if you go to the Baby Einstein website now, there's no, the word educational doesn't turn up.
Let's
and
go
that's
back.
Because of our complaint.
Very good. And I want to talk a little bit about the group and the political work in a second, but let's go right now back to the phone lines to yet another caller. Line 1, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Susan Lynn.
Hello. Just a quick follow-up with the previous caller. At the end of the program, Empire of the Air, Norman Corwin was asked a question or tells a story about how, the daughter of a friend of his or some young child in the very early days of television was asked which she liked better, television or radio, and she said radio. He said, why? Well, the pictures are better. Anyway, two things I'd like to know about. First off, this may be difficult. How are you defining toy in the sense of, when I think back, Frank Lloyd Wright credited much of his development to the fact that when he was very young, his mother gave him a set of Fraible blocks, which are just simple shapes. You know, there's nothing to them at all. You stack them up and do with them what you want and use your imagination. And the other is, being an old geezer, I can remember when McDonald's hamburgers were a dime and they didn't have anything called a play place, which these things make me think that big chains like that, McDonald's, Burger King, and so forth, that have these things are really hooking children, you know, making the coming to get a hamburger part of some experience that they are therefore branded for life and get to get them into the habit of regularly consuming foodstuffs that probably aren't the best for them and probably far more often than they should and so forth. Did you look into the or have any comment on the attempts of various corporations to, start real young and develop a consumer for life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. And indeed, I can begin the answer by saying Susan Lynn has done a lot of work in this area. And I think perhaps it might be a chance for you to develop this because of the importance of your argument of the sort of commercial pressure. And I think a lot of people, even people with small children, parents, don't quite realize the immense size of the industries that are arrayed trying to commercialize childhood.
Yes, and to put it in perspective, in 1983, companies were spending $100 million annually in the United States marketing to children, and now they're spending, or the last figure I saw, which was a couple years ago, was $17 billion. I mean, it's just a huge, huge increase. It's an enormous industry. Licensed toys brought in $22 billion last year. Toys linked to television programs and things like that. It's an enormous industry, and that is really working day and night to bypass parents and to target children with messages not necessarily or even usually designed to help their lives, help them have better lives, but really designed to hook them on brands from infancy. So, you know, there are 40,000 Disney princess items on the market. And that's so ironic, I mean, because the grandchildren of the 1960s feminists, the granddaughters, are leading lives that are much more constricted by gender because of the commercialization of childhood.
You know, you explain that a lot in the book, Susan Lynn, The Case for Make-Believe, your new book. And it's some of the best work in the book. You call it the princess trap.
Right.
Talking about girls. Explain that a little bit more, if you would.
Well, it's hard to find toys and baby products that aren't plastered with some kind of media character. And that's because what happens is that the babies see the care. Babies thrive on familiarity. And so the more they see something, the more they like it. And so, you know, if you bring your daughter home to a Disney princess bedroom and everything she has is a Disney princess and her diapers have Disney princesses on them, then she associates those characters with love and warmth and mom, and they actually become what she needs. Parents think every time a child sees Elmo, because the baby starts to smile, they think that the child has to have Elmo. So they buy the baby or the toddler lots and lots and lots of Elmo toys, and then it does become that. But it doesn't have to be that. It could be, you know, really just about anything that the baby was familiar with. And with girls, you know, with boys it's violence. With girls it's these highly sexualized toys like the Disney princess toys. And in the book I talk about playing with this little girl, this little four-year-old, and she was completely immersed in the princesses. And if children are immersed in these these films and these television programs, we need to let them play about it because it's how they work things out. We can't stop them from playing about it. So we were playing princess, and I spilled something, and I was scrubbing it up, and I said, "I feel like Cinderella." And she was outraged, and she was right to be, because when you play Cinderella with a little girl, you don't get to be Cinderella. She gets to be Cinderella. She said, "You're not Cinderella." And I said, "Well, then who am I?" And she said, "You're Anastasia." Well, Anastasia is the tall, skinny stepsister in Disney Cinderella. And I said, also rightfully, I thought, "Anastasia never scrubbed a floor in her life." And she said, "She does in Cinderella 3. And I said, "There is a Cinderella 3? And she said, "Yes, after Cinderella gets married." So it's not just that we have, you know, these movies and these television shows. We have all of these sequels that don't even have any of the creative spark of that the first one might have had and are designed solely to keep the kids hooked on the brands.
Susan Lynn, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Susan Lynn, the author, again, of the book we've been talking about, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, just out in paper by New Press, to much acclaim. You know, I think we shouldn't go much further without talking about what we can do about it. Obviously, you recommend and And you've emphasized the importance of parents taking as much responsibility as they can in this area. But, you know, at a certain extent, and I've had this conversation with others, they sort of say when you talk about solutions that involve personal responsibility entirely, in this culture where you've got, you know, literally $20, $30, $40 billion of money being made on the backs of forcing commercialism and new technology on kids, you sort of feel like you're encouraging people to be the book people in Fahrenheit 451. Where you're just going to go off and hide from the world and then wait till the world collapses and come back out of the forest. And it's not really a very promising scenario for the future.
No, it's not.
How do you see, realistically, a way that people can address the problems you outline in the book, which are taken to their logical extreme, or logical, not extreme, but logical point of conclusion, are disastrous for our future?
I think we need to look at the commercialization of childhood and, certainly the commercialization of play as a social political issue. And we have to address it that way. And that we need to work to change society, that families can't do this on their own. And I'm certainly not recommending that people move off to the woods and unplug. I mean, it would be hypocritical. I certainly haven't, done that. But I think that what we need to do, and not just parents, but anybody who cares about children or even who cares about democracy or the environment, we need to take on the commercialization of childhood. And so I and some colleagues 9 years ago started the campaign for a commercial-free childhood. We are a national organization, the only national organization devoted to stopping the commercial exploitation of children. And we look on this as an issue of rights and freedoms, the rights of children to grow up and the freedom for parents to raise them without being undermined by commercial interests. And we work through any legal means possible to take on corporations and to work with the government in any way that we can, to take back childhood from corporate marketers, and this issue, it's so serious and it's so important because there's so much at stake, and it's not just creative play, childhood obesity, eating disorders, sexualization, youth violence. Family stress, the acquisition of materialistic values, all of those social and public health problems are linked to advertising and marketing. So, and we have had actually surprising successes. We started out with 10 of us around the table. Our email list is up to 30,000. I mentioned our Federal Trade Commission complaint, which did get Disney and Brainy Baby to change some of the ways that those videos are marketing. We also ran a successful campaign to stop McDonald's from at a school in Seminole County, Florida. Kids were going home with their report cards in a McDonald's envelope. A mother called and said, I can't get anybody to listen to me. Can you do something? We said, yes, we can. We'll start a letter writing campaign. And one thing, we've been successful, and we work very carefully. And so the press takes us very seriously now. And we sent out our press release when we started the letter writing campaign. And Stuart Elliott of the New York Times did a whole article about it. There was an AP article. Stephen Colbert did a bit on it. And that's the way. We don't have an advertising budget. We're this, like every other nonprofit, this struggling nonprofit, we don't have an advertising budget, but we work through the press that way. And there was so much public outrage that McDonald's actually pulled the program.
Susan Lynn, you look at many countries in Europe that ban advertising to children under the age of, say, 12 or 10. Even in the United States, many Americans aren't aware of the fact that the Federal Trade Commission considered in the 1970s, as recently as that, banning advertising to children on television. It seems like what you're talking about is great, but it's sort of a drop in the bucket compared to really the sort of measures that would really clean the slate.
Right. But yes, but the first thing that has to happen is to raise awareness, to build the public will, to foment change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's not in corporations' interest to stop marketing to kids. It's going to have to be a grassroots movement that puts enough pressure on the corporations and on the government.
We've got a couple callers waiting patiently to talk with Susan Lynn, and we've got about 10 minutes left in the show, so I want to make sure we get both of them in. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. First, we'll go to line 4, Chicago. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Susan Lynn.
Hi. Have you investigated the Chuck E. Cheese Busters franchise experience? It is clearly a pre-adult casino experience for children. You put a coin in these machines, a lot of bells ring, and this little prize zips out that's fairly worthless. Wondered if you'd investigate that, knew who actually owned those outfits. I would not be surprised if it's Bally or some larger corporation like that. But kids love the places, unfortunately.
Thank you very much, caller. Yes, Susan Lynn?
Well, we, CCFC, the Campaign for Commercial for Childhood, has not taken this issue on, but I urge the caller to send us an email. You can go to our website. Our email address, our website is commercialfreechildhood.org, and you can. There's a way to send us an email and send us information about that, and maybe we can take a look on it. A lot of the things that we take on come from people, people who, contact us about one thing or another that they're outraged about.
Let's go to the phone lines again now to line 1, Chicago. You're on the air with Susan Lynn.
The example of the tobacco industry is finally being taken on by the government and the people to address the matter of smoking, ravaging our health and so forth, and also its effect on younger people to indulge in these matters. And then we have the doors closed on advertising for that area, only to have them insidiously make it humorous in the form of cartoons and still smoking and the visual TV by the actors and so forth. And then we have the matter of alcohol and everything suddenly creeping and making inroads back into the public displays on TV. So we have all these steps backward getting away from advertising, but then we have them sort of slipping around the corner and getting into other areas that are just horrible examples of the effects of advertising. But then they call it freedom of speech, and you can't curtail, what the corporate ability to make profit is, and so we're in that kind of bind. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Susan Lynn, any comments on that?
Well, I think that at the Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, we're not naive about how huge the problem is and how much effort it's going to take to make changes, but whatever changes happen with tobacco happen only after a huge amount of grassroots effort. And the same thing is going to, the same thing is true about the whole issue of marketing to children. I just think it's too important. I mean, one thing that's clear is that if we roll over and take it, I mean, as you said, Bob, it's going to be a disaster.
You know, one of the authors you cite in the book in your recommended readings and someone who's influenced you, it's obvious by reading your work and many others, including myself, is Neil Postman, the late great professor at New York University. And Postman shared similar concerns as yours, but he really didn't look specifically at childhood. He started with childhood but ended up towards the end of his career with concerns about all of us, the entire population, the adult culture as well. Do you share that sort of concern that Postman has, not only that what it does to us as children will affect us throughout our lives and affect society, but even adults, all of us are too immersed in commercialism and these technologies?
I absolutely share his concern. And in terms of thinking about what to do about it, I mean, my feeling and the feeling of my colleagues is that we can take on a slice on of it. And we have to remember that children become the adults in society. And so that's why we focus on children, because they're the future. Our future is literally in their hands.
And, you know, Susan Lynn, I, before we close, there's a section of the book that I think is of great importance we haven't talked about yet that goes into sort of the industry of marketing to young people. And there are two sets of letters, KGOY and KSYL, which sound like radio stations in the western half of the country, but aren't. what do those two sets of letters mean? Why are they important? And what does it have to do with something you call middle childhood?
Well, it's kids getting older younger, and kids staying younger longer.
Mm-hmm.
And those are advertising terms, and have to do with the fact that essentially the marketing industry wants everybody to be 17 and treats everybody as though they are 17 pretty much. I mean, that they treat 3-year-olds as though they're 17, and 39-year-olds are told that they're supposed to look like they're 17. And so and so on. And what happens with the kids getting older, younger, the advertising industry presents it as a fact, but there's evidence that kids are getting the trappings of maturity earlier, but there's no evidence that their cognitive or social or emotional development is keeping up in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But what the marketing industry uses that as an excuse to market to preschoolers as though they were teenagers. And so what we have is very young children getting the kind of concerns of adolescence, and we have preschool girls worried about their bodies and that they're too fat. And I was watching a 3-year-old play the other day, and she was all immersed in boyfriends and all of this stuff that, the kids aspire to be older, and they look up to older people, to older kids. They look up to older kids. But if what the media and toys that these little girls are inundated with, if they're all about teenage girls, they're missing middle childhood, which is a time of incredible creativity for kids, and are especially important for girls because it's a time when they've got all their basic skills and they're not worrying about what they look like or their body, and they aren't in the throes of all that, those hormonal changes. So it's a time of great creativity and great productivity for children. It can be. But the problem is that with all of, you know, the Bratz dolls and the princess dolls, that the kids are being robbed of that, and they're supposed to go from being 3 to 13.
We've only got about a minute left, Susan Lynn, and I just want to ask you finally, if there were one policy measure that you could recommend that was adopted by the United States government to address the problems you chronicle in The Case for Make-Believe, what would it be?
Well, the first thing we have to do, I've got to do two, because the first thing we have to do is restore the power of the Federal Trade Commission to regulate marketing to kids, because it was severely restricted. So we have to do that. And then I think that we should prohibit marketing to children under the age of 12. But, Bob, that's a whole other program.
No, I understand. But I mean,
about that. But I think we've got to stop it. It's not good for them. There's so much evidence that it's not good for them.
And again, if people want to find out more about the work, not just getting your book, Susan Lynn, The Case for Make-Believe, but also about the work of the Campaign for Child-Free or Commercial-Free Childhood,
Where do they go again?
What's the website for that?
It's commercialfreechildhood.org. And you know, you can go online. You can see all the stuff that we've been doing. We've been doing some really great stuff.
You know, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want me out of the studio. Susan Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. Actually, it was really fun to talk to you. It always is.
Okay, I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank my producer, Andrea Boyle, Kyle Krohoff, for working the board. And I'll be back in 167 hours. Everyone have a great week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
As of right now, we're still $126,000 away from having the money we'll need to provide you with the news and information you count on us for in the new fiscal year that begins Wednesday. So call now, 217-244-9455 with a pledge.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we should have more comfortable temperatures for the next few days. Today, sunny skies with a high of 85 degrees. Tonight, clear with a low around 60. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 83. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low of 58. And Tuesday, partly sunny skies with a high of 78 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.